Hello and welcome to Starts and Grafts. I'm Conor Gafog and each week I'm joined by an emerging artist to discuss the highs and lows of forging a creative career during a global pandemic. My guest this week is Ken Nakajima, an artist whose work spans across many disciplines, including dance, theatre and visual arts. A performer since a young age, he's starred in shows at the National Opera House in Tokyo and has even represented the UK at World Street Dance Championships. So Ken, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good, man. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's really good to have someone on that's a movement artist. We've not had one on yet. Where are you recording from today?
Just Hertfordshire, so just outside of North London.
Okay, is that where you're based?
Yes, it's where the home is, where I am, it's where I come to and travelling to uni as well, yeah.
Cool. So, like I said, you're the first movement artist that we've had on the podcast, which provides a really good opportunity for me to learn quite a lot. And I'm looking forward to gaining a bit of insight into what that really entails and how it's affected you, you know, during the pandemic. I speak to a lot of people that work in theatre or that are musicians, and their experiences have been quite different from one another. So let's see what's been going on in your life over the last 12 months. Can we unpack the term movement artist a little bit to begin? What does that mean to you?
To me, movement artist, I think it was the most simplest way to kind of describe my practice to the general, like, people. In a sense, I think it's more of like a inclusive way of saying what I am, because if I said what I do, I feel like, you know, I think everyone would kind of fall asleep or everyone would get really confused. And of course, movement artist to me, because I like to blend dance and theatre into kind of a singular practice rather than focusing on techniques and styles. I kind of try and mush them up together. And I couldn't really find a term for that.
So it almost encapsulates rather than defines, you know, it takes into account theatre and dance, like you just said, I suppose.
Yeah.
What is it then that draws you to make art in this way through your body? How did that come about?
Well, of course, it started out with, you know, my dance training from a young age, and like it was really my only way to kind of describe the way I truly feel, because I'm not a very an open person. I don't, you know, talk about my feelings or how I think a lot.
Right.
So this is kind of my only way to express those feelings and express those, you know, anxieties or stress or joy. But then when theatre came along, I just thought, well, there must be a way that I can blend these two together to create some sort of language that I can speak and perhaps other people can share and learn as well.
What do you think the body offers that potentially the voice or the written word doesn't, if that makes sense? Or what is the appeal to you there?
Yeah, I think sometimes there are things that you can't describe in words, and it's only through gesture and body and feeling. And I think movement is kind of like a tool to use to express those feelings, or like, and sometimes, yeah, as I said, words can't. I'm not saying it can't. I'm not saying, because, you know, there's poetry and, you know, there's beautiful texts in theatre, but to really kind of describe what's inside, I think movement is kind of like the best way to translate that.
For me, I don't think we completely realise how much of an impact movement has within our everyday communication. And the terms of,
yeah.
I think when people think of movement in a performance sense, sometimes it automatically dances the thing that they go straight to in their heads. But when you think of things like gesture and how a really thought through and controlled gesture can communicate something, I suppose there's a lot to really offer there. And like I just said, it's a huge part of our everyday communication. I'm here now nodding away and we're nodding at each other.
And it's when you stylize that, those simple gestures, everyday gestures or rituals, then you see something that's really interesting and performative. Because, like, you could, for example, like if you just kind of repeat a gesture that you do every day and then start exploring that, that repetition and just go from there and maybe add another movement to it or another gesture and just kind of create a motif. Another thing as well, I've seen some actors on stage where they're not aware of their body, where they think it's just what's in here and what they say rather than their body. Because you see a lot where people fiddle, or another thing they do, you'll probably see this, is where they step back and they step in front. So it's like they do this a lot with their feet because they don't know where to position themselves or how to ground themselves. So I think it's just as vital for actors to really know their body in order to perform better or have that awareness, I think.
The way that you've just articulated that to me hints to your interest in directing, which you're not just a performer, you know, you do lots of directing yourself. Is that something that stemmed from performing? Did you then think, I'm noticing things here, like you've just discussed, and I want to have a say and help people realise the potential that movement has within a performance?
Yeah, and it's always been a thing. I think always since I was a kid, I've always wanted to like lead something, direct, or like, I honestly wanted to be a conductor when I was little.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I think that comes from like when I used to work in the opera, just kind of admiring how the conductor like just controls, but also shares that experience with the ensemble. And I just thought from a young age, I was like, I want to like direct something. But the opportunity to direct only came probably about when I was in uni during my theatre course. And, you know, kind of working with different directors, and especially when I worked with TJ, Munotita Chang.
Yeah, who was on the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, and Simone Gistolini. We all worked together on the Rome Project with Gilgamesh, and then just watching those two people just do their thing. And I was just like, that was like another trigger of me to kind of take it more seriously. So that's when I started to begin like really going for it and directing it. So I took directing modules and like anywhere I can, I could direct something or choreograph something. That was it, I think.
And then you were hooked. I know a lot of your practice really involves other elements of design. You mentioned Tida, who's been on the podcast, and a lot of her work is really focused on sound design, but you're interested in lighting, which is a completely different aspect.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your interest in lighting and what you think that can do to, I don't know if aid's the right word, but support a piece of movement, for example.
I've always been interested in lighting. Same again, even as a kid, because I love films, and I love how films like light the space or how they immerse a scene or the cinematography. And I always thought I'd love to be able to control an environment or a scene with the light. And then it was only until when I started doing production arts during my A-levels, that's when I started to kind of learn like the actual technical way of doing it. And then I just carried it on through uni. And then, and Middlesex University that I was at, they had a lot of really nice, lovely equipment there. So I had a lot of time to play with. And then it's just, for me, it's just creating the space, creating this atmosphere. That's really important to me. I just can't just focus on one practice and just do that. When I direct or create a piece, I think about the whole world of the piece. And with movement as well, like especially dance lighting, I think I use that a lot whenever I can, just to kind of pick up the body. And I think lighting is the best way to pick up the body of what you're seeing on stage. I guess that's just basic lighting. Illuminating the body. Yeah.
I think there's a lot to be said in the ways that you can take a specific practice or piece of performance like movement and really manipulate it to tell a story. I mean, I am by no means a movement artist. I'm just going to put that out there. But I do know for my, when I did my kind of practical dissertation when I was doing a theatre degree myself, I wanted to communicate something which kind of drew upon the internal, you know, the internal aspects of a person and the external. And straight away I turned to movement to do that. And I'd focus on a piece called, some ridiculous name like Sweet Metal Road Bread, I think is a piece by a movement company called Station House Opera. And I turned to that and it was like intermedia. So I had a pre-recorded movement piece on a screen that was at the back of the theatre, at the back of the space, and then live performance in front of it. And it was amazing putting the two in conversation with each other.
Wow.
How movement in different ways alongside, and I mean, it wasn't particularly great, I'm going to put that out there, but conceptually, and what I learned from it, it really made me tune in with what the body has got to offer. And as a student, when you can learn something like that, it completely shifts, doesn't it? It completely shifts your perspective of performance, or it did for me. But that's a little bit of a self-indulgent ramble from me about what I've done, and that's not...
Oh, it sounds cool, man. It sounds really cool, actually.
That's not why we're here. So let's talk about some of your work and how it's been affected by the pandemic. Uh-huh. What projects, if any, did you have lined up for the past 12 months? And
So
I feel like there's going to be quite a few here with that response.
First, I would say, was I think working with Tida again on two things. Hopefully I was going to work with her doing the Rome project, where we perform at the National Theatre of Rome, mm. with the Arts Festival there and Middlesex University. Three venues lined up for Gilgamesh to do it in London again, because we always had discussions of like kind of bringing it back since we did it back in 2018. I was meant to go to Portugal to present Sempre, which is the show I premiered February in 2020, and I wanted to bring it back.
Right.
And then Berlin, I was meant to do like a small project there. And then November, I was meant to go to Brussels for a couple of weeks to do a dance project. And that all got scrapped.
I'm kind of in awe of all the different places that you've just mentioned there. Is there, how do these opportunities come up to be taking your work across Europe like that?
I don't know, just right place at the right time, applying. That's the only thing I like about social media, is that there's a lot of things out there, you know, because, you know, back in the day, you know, you see it on like a newspaper or a magazine, but now that is such, you get such a wider scope of like work or like really cool things. And you know, it's always been my thing to work in Europe, to kind of get my work out of there. And, you know, 2020 at the start, I was just like, oh, you know, this is going to be the year where I can, you know, kind of just throw myself out there in Europe and just do my thing and just see how it goes. But also just, yeah, networking. Yeah, it's just networking and applications, really.
It's incredible how willing people are to get involved in things. And especially now, I mean, we put a call out for artists on our Instagram, and the response that we had was like, wow, it's so good to see that there's creatives out there wanting to talk about their experiences. But do you think there's something about movement art particularly and things that we don't necessarily see within traditional spaces in the UK, for example, that really lends itself to Europe mm. and other parts of the world? Because we're quite, I think from my conversation from Tida, I realised that in the UK we're still quite traditional in terms of our tastes when it comes to watching.
Oh, you're damn right about that.
Let's talk about that. Tell me some more then, because it seems like you've got some opinions.
Do you know what? It frustrates me. And maybe I'm, you know, because I'm young, maybe I'm being naive at the same time. But from my perspective, it's just, I think we're slightly behind.
Okay.
Or like, I don't know what it is, that there's this pride that we have in what we do. And yeah, damn right, British theatre, we do produce a lot of good work. But at the same time, I think there is a lack of experimentation. And especially that is held by, you know, the big guys in the theatres. They don't allow that because... really, some theatres, they just want to make money, and it's such a shame. And it's just that imbalance of artistic value and economical value. But whereas, from what I see in Europe, that they uphold the artistic value. But yeah, I think there is a disbalance here. And, you know, I think to myself, who's the next Frantic Assembly? Who's the next Gecko Theatre? Who's the next DVA? We're not seeing that experimentation or that platform to experiment here. So, I don't know, it's just sad, because I do want to change that here. But yeah, Europe's, I think, my place to be at the moment.
That's cool, and I'm excited to see what... We'll talk about what the future holds later on, actually. Let's not go into that just yet. But I think it's true, and I think you need those game changers. And I think what's happened throughout these past 12 months has really highlighted the... way that the establishment in the UK looks towards its art scene.
Yeah.
When you compare it to some of the support in the rest of Europe that countries have provided their freelancers and their artists, and mm-hmm. we're kind of here questioning, well, we're not, but people here are questioning whether the arts are viable. As an artist that works in the way you do, has the pandemic affected you in the sense that you've not been able to access certain spaces that I'd assume you'd need?
Yeah.
How have you tried to combat that?
It was tough, man. It was it's really tough because when you do movement, you need a space. And yes, I am grateful and I'm privileged that I've been okay during the pandemic. But in an artistic sense, it has been very limiting. And like, I can't just, you know, fully just go for it in my house. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to rip up the carpet or like damage the flooring. So it was just that lack of experimentation, or rather restriction of experimentation. And it's different as well, because it's just like you can't really, yeah, you can collaborate over Zoom or like do digital stuff. And, you know, digital theatre has been a great thing. But then again, it's like, it's not enough. Do you know what I mean? It's like eating your favourite meal, but only getting a bite out of it every once in a while. And they just take it away from you. And that's what it feels like. So it has been, yeah, do you know what I mean? And it's just,
yeah,
it's tough. You need that rehearsal space. You need a space where you can just go for it.
And you've just talked about collaborating, which for so many of us is so important. And the fact that maybe we can collaborate from a distance, but a huge part of dance is being able to touch people and being able to physically feel and connect and show that connection through the body. And I can only be concerned at how long social distancing measures will be in place and the impact that that's going to have on being able to create work that requires a physical connection.
That's a huge thing about as well, because I'm very comfortable with touch, and I guess that comes from like dance and like doing theatre. And it's just such a shame that we can't, I know it sounds weird, but we can't touch each other. There's so much that a physical gesture, a physical contact can offer. Even that, you know, a hand on the shoulder or just a hug for like a second, there's that exchange of comfort that it offers to people. And because we haven't had that, I don't know about you, but I just feel like whenever I do Zoom calls or like lectures online or whatever, it's just afterwards that you just feel so depressed about it. Because it's like, yes, I'm seeing the people that I like and I want to talk to, but because that physical interaction is not there. And I feel like my mind kind of registers that after the Zoom call, and you're just like, ugh, damn, here I am again.
But it's also being able to interpret or really be able to gauge a person, and this is the first time we're speaking, which is fantastic. But like, you almost want to be able to see the full person and how they conduct themselves and their body language and stuff, and how they present themselves, because that is a huge part of who we are. And yeah, it's really, really difficult not being able to do that at the moment. But anyway, let's kind of, because you have been able to do some things, so let's talk about those for a minute, and sure, not sell you, but let's be a bit more positive. So Lanoia is a piece that you've been working on for some time, I think.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that and its journey over the last year or so.
Sure. So Lanoia, it was kind of funny when I came up with it. It was at a point where I just didn't want to create. I couldn't do anything. So in a way, it came from a place of like kind of forcing it out. But then at the same time, it was really funny because I was like, huh. It was more of almost a realization as well. It's like I was kind of reflecting on how I was feeling when I didn't want to create. And in a way, I was kind of drawing those feelings out to do that. But also, it was an accident as well, because I came across this photographic essay called Seeking Comfort in Uncomfortable Chairs by an artist called Bruno Minari. And in his photographic essay, he basically critiques modernist furniture, because this was kind of, he did this in the 40s, and he was really pissed off with like how every furniture was becoming modernist and it was so uncomfortable to sit on. So in this photographs, he purposefully sits uncomfortably on this chair just to kind of describe this anger and frustration that he has. And I just saw the way he positions himself, and I was like, oh, I could do something with this. This could really help. And that was like another trigger for Lanoia. And so I just took what I had and what I felt during lockdown and that essay and just kind of just bunched it up together. And all these ideas start to come about, and you know, talking about discomfort and boredom. And there's a book called Lanoia as well by Alberto Moravia. And in the first chapter, he talks about boredom, and the way he describes it is another inspiration as well. And not just to paraphrase it, he basically says, so you know when you're cold at night and you're sleeping, your chest gets cold, so you pull the cover up, and then your feet gets cold because it's exposed. So you pull the cover down to cover your feet, but now your chest is exposed, now it's cold. And it's like this endless repetition of bored or being bored. And that was it for me, I think. And that's all connected together. And then I just started playing with like awkward positions, and yeah, that was it. And that's how I started, just repeating those awkward gestures and movements, and then just adding on narrative structures. For example, there's a Greek myth about Tantalus. So he's forever tormented in this pond, and there's a fruit tree. So the fruit is so close for him to take it. But every time he tries to take it, the branch just goes up. So the fruit just goes higher and higher and higher, and he can't reach it. And when he's thirsty, he tries to drink the water, but the water recedes. So he's in this endless torment. And yeah, so it was like a mixture of all those things. And then I just basically just went for it.
Wow, like what incredible inspirations behind it. And I really enjoyed the idea of the kind of the bedsheet moving back and forth between this kind of never ending something being vulnerable or that you don't want it to be. And I'm obsessed with this idea of being bored of being bored, because wow, is that relevant right now? And I'm guessing that was kind of what fueled you to go on and make the piece. I'm guessing it is really based in what we're experiencing at the moment.
Absolutely. And you know, it was really funny because at the time I was like, I don't want to make art about COVID. I don't want to do that. But then I couldn't not do, do you know what I mean? It was inevitable that I had to do something based on those feelings and in a sense the suffering as well that I went through. Because I think we all share that suffering right now.
And I think I'm actually going to kind of change the way that I plan this conversation to go a little bit now, because
sure,
we always include a piece of artist advice in the conversation. We gather it beforehand, and I was going to talk a piece of advice that we gained from Simon Stevens, but I actually recently fortunate enough to speak in person to a writer called Hanif Qureshi, who has wrote some incredible texts like The Buddha of Suburbia and My Beautiful Laundrette. But I was talking to him and I was asking him during our conversation, what would you say to anyone that's struggling to gain inspiration at this moment in time? And he just said, no matter what you think, this is a really interesting time that we're in right now. He said, it might be difficult. And he said, I'd be concerned almost if people can't gain inspiration from that, from what they're feeling and what they're going through. And it sounds like you've done exactly that when making Lanoia, which is incredible. And I mean, you haven't been able to perform it in front of a live audience, I don't think.
No, not yet.
But you have recently streamed it, haven't you?
Yeah.
Or a section of it.
I did a section because originally I was meant to be performing the whole show on the January 22nd at Centre St Martin's at the Platform Theatre. But then lockdown happened and I couldn't do it. And I just thought, I really wanted to share this somehow. So I thought, why not film an extract and just put it out there? It kind of offered me peace to get the work out there, but also to share this to the people that I wanted to share it with. And I felt like at the time I was networking with like just a couple of quite important people. And so what I did was I have an undecorated living room at the moment because I moved into this house during the summer and we haven't had a chance to get it decorated fully. So it's just this white space and just this black flooring. And I got my sister to film and edit it for me. She does all that in A-levels at the moment. So I just thought, well, that's perfect for your practice and my practice. Let's do something together, sibling collaboration, why not? And then we just went for it.
That's so cool. I've watched it a couple of times, actually. I really enjoyed it.
But I
didn't realise I thought that was some sort of space that you had access to in terms of like a university studio or anything. It looks incredible for a living room.
Nope.
It's also filmed in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
That, again, for me, really added to the piece and the outlook of boredom and the way that people might currently be viewing the world and the situation we're in. What was that, the ideas behind it for you, or in terms of the black and white filming?
Yeah, for me, because it was a section called discomfort. For me, discomfort, especially when you're really deep in the hole and like, or just stuck in a void, I didn't think there's any colours, and I just thought, I don't want any other colours kind of popping out. And I just thought, why not just drain it completely and just make an honest piece as I can and an honest way of describing how I felt. And that's my only way to kind of really be truthful about how I felt, or in a way reflecting on how I felt through the art. And I just thought, well, black and white seems really plausible, drowns any other distractions. It's just the movement, the chair and the space, nothing more than that. But also obviously, you know, inspiration from films like Cold War, like 8.5 by Federico Fellini, and yeah, a mixture of that.
There's a beauty, I think, in the simplicity of it. And it's part of, there's more work to come in the sequence, or it's part of a trilogy, I think.
Yes, so the La Noia is part of a trilogy. So it started off with Sempre, which was about nostalgia and the process of loss. And then La Noia is about discomfort and boredom. And then the third one is Crowds, which is kind of like a summary of everything that's happened in this trilogy all in one. So it's kind of a much longer performance. There's seven sections. Hopefully I can get seven sections. Fingers crossed. And hoping I can get like 10 to 15 performers and, you know, kind of explores what it really is to be human through like themes about love, existentialism, boredom again, technology, violence. So yeah, it's just kind of my observation of our contemporary society and the youth and technology all in one space, and mental health as well, all in one space together, and just how I feel about. Actually, no, you know that feeling when you get when you're in a crowd, but you're not really in the crowd, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That was like the core essence of Crowds. But yeah, and that's the trilogy. It's called Yugen Trilogy. And Yugen means, in Japanese, basically the profound sense of mystery of the universe, but also the sad beauty of the human condition. And I just thought that was like the perfect way to describe what I'm doing. And yeah,
I think that feeling that you've just spoken about straight away, I was like, oh yeah, I can really resonate with that. I think I've experienced that loads of times at festivals, weirdly,
yeah.
When I've been in a big crowd of people and everyone else has seemed so engaged with the music and the performance. And I've kind of had this, and I'm sure lots of people have, this moment of being so far away from what is going on and the people that are experiencing it. And your mind just wanders, and it's a really interesting and surreal experience. But you mentioned mental health there, which has kind of been a huge thing for a lot of
Absolutely.
For a lot of us, and it's really over the last 12 months our mental health has been affected in very different ways. But I just wanted to know, outside of making work, if there's been anything else that you've turned to over the last 12 months to keep you going, really.
Not much.
A very broad question.
I think, because I'm quite a stubborn person, and you know, when the lockdown happened, you know, I just saw all these people just picking up different hobbies and stuff like that. And for me, like, I don't want to sound boring, but I don't really have like a hobby like gardening or like going for a run or, I don't know, planting stuff. I don't want to do that. Like, all I want to do is, that sounds really cliche, but like, all I want to do is make art or some form of art. And, you know, whether that is trying to just kind of explore within a confined space or just kind of designing stuff. Like, for example, I did a design project called Soul Collection, which basically I ask every participant a color that they feel most connected to, and I design them their digital soul based on what they've asked for. And that was kind of sort of like a feel good thing as well. So just kind of offering comfort through design. That's something I went towards as well, and for myself as well. So I just started like designing random lighting design concepts on like softwares and just kind of keeping those for the future and just basically building up research and work for the better days. That's kind of what I was doing.
So it sounds like digital and visual arts kind of taken the forefront and taken a step forward where performance would normally kind of sit in your everyday kind of making.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. And like you just said, you talked about the stubbornness, which I really respect. But I suppose for you, it's quite interesting because you have been performing from such a young age. Is this almost the longest period you've been without a live audience?
Yeah.
How does that feel? That must be insane. And driving you insane, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the thing, isn't it? For me, like, the audience is so important. And, you know, I would never blame the audience for anything. Do you know what I mean? It's up to me to make that connection with the audience, whether if they like it or not. You know, I want a reaction. So when you have to turn to a digital audience, you're literally throwing your work into a void. A digital audience is weird, but it's also very anxious at the same time because it's social media and, you know, there is this pressure with artists, with social media, that we have to produce the best as we can every time just for those likes and just for those shares and just for those, you know, notifications. And it's just so frustrating and overwhelming. But with a real audience, I guess, it's just more straightforward, isn't it? They watch it, they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. Simple as that. And that connection, that physical connection that you make with the audience. I'm grateful that there's online theatre, and I'm grateful it has been accessible for a lot of people. But at the same time, I'm worried about the future of art and theatre in that sense.
Can we talk about for a moment some of your earlier performances? So like I mentioned, you performed quite a lot when you were much younger at the Royal Opera House in Tokyo.
Yeah, that's
in some pretty major productions. I'm guessing that's where you grew up, but tell me how those experiences came about.
So, God, I think the earliest memory I have of a performance was in Madame Butterfly at the National Theatre in Tokyo there. And that was like my first ever production. And it was huge as well. It was massive. It was like a big opera. And I don't know, I think. And then having been called back to do like two shows per year for like seasons. And it was such a phenomenal and such a privileged experience that I could never forget. And I think from doing that, a lot of my influences have come from, or the basis of influences of the design and like spacing and performance comes from those early days of performing in the opera.
You talked about them being such huge productions, and that is a big platform, I think, to be performing on a stage like that in any country, really. But when you were that age, well, how old were you when you were performing in Madame Butterfly?
I was 5, turning 6.
Did you realise the sheer size of it and what you were taking part in?
No, because I was such a curious kid and just willing to do anything. I was just like, you know what, yeah, let's do this. So I didn't really pay attention to the grandness of it. Do you know what I mean? I just felt that I was in a really comfortable space. And, you know, at the time, you know, I didn't really have a great childhood in terms of like schooling and stuff, you know, I was bullied. And so for me, like working in the opera was like my kind of getaway from not reality, but like that reality that I had to go back to after I finished the production, go back to school and et cetera, and just see people, well, not many friends, but you know what I mean? But yeah, it was, I never really paid attention to the grandness of it. It was more just the experience and the feeling of being included and working with all these professionals, regardless of age and like experience, everyone just coming together and making a piece of theatre. And that's what was always been special to me.
You know, you just talked a little bit about your school life and things like that. Do you feel almost, I don't know if fortunate is the right word, but I'm going to use it, fortunate that you were able to find the space that really made you feel you and the space that felt safe to you at quite a young age?
Yeah.
Being able to find a creative space, because for quite a lot of people, it takes a lot of time to be able to find out what really makes them tick, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think, you know, you're a child, you know what I mean? There's a lot of things to go through and experience. And, you know, at the time, you're not really thinking about a lot of serious things. But when you're confronted with like serious things at a young age, you kind of, I don't want to say mature early, but you kind of have certain realizations of certain things in life. And for me, that was theatre in a sense that, I don't know. It's a good question, actually. Sorry, I told you, I go off on a tangent. Like, it's really bad.
No, it's cool. So what I wanted to ask, because I'm not particularly clued up on the arts and culture scene in Japan, is it very accessible to or for young people to get involved in creative projects and performance opportunities?
No, it's not. It's very... That's the only thing about Japan. A lot of good work come out of there in terms of art, but in terms of like platforming, it's very, very difficult and very picky. So for me, I was very lucky to be picked to do those things, because it's a very traditional place and but at the same time, a very modern place. And like, but the culture is very conservative in terms of with the arts as well. It's really weird. It's such a place full of contradictions and full of beauty, but also at the same time, there's not a lot of platform for artists, I don't think. It's very like media heavy, very like boy band, girl band heavy. Yeah, you know, commercial stuff is very heavy there.
Right, okay, so it's kind of a mixture of that commercial and the traditional.
Yeah, yeah.
So how, for example, would the art that you're making at the moment fit in over there, if that makes sense? That laugh suggests several things.
I don't know. I've never thought about it. Because of, like, the experience that I had growing up as a kid, I never really paid attention to, like, Japan after I moved here.
Mm.
When I moved here, you know, I had the focus of like trying to learn, you know, reading, writing English and like education and just kind of getting my head out and trying to adjust to a different culture. And from that, I never really thought about putting my work into Japan, if that makes sense. And I'm sure they would, I guess they would appreciate it, because I know the art scene there is pretty cool. The underground art scene is there pretty cool. So I think there is some sort of appreciation that would be made in terms of what I'm making.
But sure.
That's something I don't really think about.
So then, At what point, let's touch upon street dance a little bit. Is that something that's always been a part of your life, or did you kind of pick that up when you moved over here?
No, I started, my first style of dance that I started when I was a kid was hip hop. Because, you know, my controversial, but when I saw Chris Brown dancing in like a music video and Michael Jackson and like, and then the Jabberwockies, like one of the best dance crews ever. When I saw them on MTV Japan, I was just like, I want to do that. That's so cool. I want to do that. And then I just started taking classes, and then I just kind of carried it on. And it's still part of me now, that kind of style, because now from hip hop, it kind of transitioned to street dance, which is more so like different styles, because it's more competitive dance that I did. So obviously I had to touch upon different styles. And then I kind of moved towards, which is now, it used to be called urban choreography. Now it's called open style. It's a dance style based in LA amongst like the American, Asian and Black community there.
Mm.
And it's a style that really focuses on like musicality and tempo and texture and kind of exploring the music and experimenting with it. And I kind of found myself there and feeling comfortable in that style. And I still try to implement it into my work when it's movement, but I'm still at that stage where I'm still figuring out how to kind of blend these movement styles into kind of one cohesive language. So yeah, I'm still figuring it out basically, but I still do street dance, hip hop. That's the base.
It's still that, I mean, learning is such a long, continuous process. And am I right in thinking that you're currently studying for your MA?
Yes.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's a really interesting thing that I want to touch upon, because I mean, you're also the first guest that's still in some sort of education setting, if that makes sense.
I'm the baby.
What is the degree that you're learning, the master's that you're studying again?
It's performance design and practice at Central Saint Martins.
So how do you study performance when performance isn't able to take place in so many ways? I know that might sound like a really dumb question, but I just want to find out what it's like at the moment to be learning those things.
Yeah, so I had the chance of being on campus for like a term from like October to December, because that's when, you know, we had like lockdown number two.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, it wasn't really a lockdown, was it?
Don't go to places if you can't, and do what, and all that kind of nonsense that none of us really understood.
Yeah, it's like, oh no, I just went to the park. Oopsie. But yeah, that was at the time, yeah. So I had the chance of like being in space and like working with like other students and stuff. And the course really focuses on the experimentation and like kind of merging different practices into one. So like we had projects where one of the projects we had is live cinema. Because the head of the course at CSM for PDP is Pete Brooks, and he's a director, and he's a damn good director. And his practice is kind of mainly blends like film and theatre into productions. And so that's some of the workshops that we did, where we tried to blend live performance and then kind of film it like a film, get it framed right and in the angles. So you would see a live performance and a film performance all at once at the same time. So kind of what Katie Mitchell has done in the past as well. And just a range of things as well, because all the people on my course come from really different backgrounds, because it's not just theatre. There's people from film, there's people from architecture, there's people from, you know, costume, fashion, jewellery design. So it's all these different like practices like thrown into one space, and we're all just kind of like trying to figure out how we can blend our practices and blend with our opposites. And that's kind of how the kind of course works. And it's really cool. But at the moment, it's very design-based and film-based. So kind of recording performances if you want, or doing animation, or at the moment we're doing the opera project where we're doing a speculative design of how we would design a full-scale opera. So I'm doing that at the moment, which is, it's really fun.
It sounds like that melting pot of talents is giving you the right toolkit to adapt and kind of push through this current period. As we start to come to the end of our conversation, I want to ask a huge question, which is, what does the future hold? Or what do you hope the future will hold for you once you've gained your MA? What would you hope that you could achieve within the next few years?
Really getting myself out there, I think, and just kind of like try and get the opportunities that I could have got back in 2020 and just throw it out there and hopefully just make a name for myself across Europe and across the world, really, I think. just to kind of experiment and just kind of work with different artists across the globe and just hopefully start my own kind of company, theatre dance company, I'm not too sure. And just, yeah, just work and collaborate. Yeah, go from there, I think.
Does it feel like there's a need to make up for lost time? Because straight away you said, achieve what I wanted to achieve in 2020 would be the first thing you'd want to do when you can. So yeah, does it feel that way?
Yeah, it's weird because at the same time there is like a pressure of like trying to get myself out there and feeling like, you know, I got pushed back for a whole year. That's another feeling that I'm kind of dealing with, but at the same time I'm very optimistic and hopeful for the future. And yeah, you know, I'm at the bottom of the pile when I go out there, but you know, I want to go up the ladder as slowly as I can. And yeah, there are going to be a lot of pushbacks and, you know, rejections, but that's all part of it. But I want to do what I have to do and I'll get there, I think.
I hope so. I think you've got a great sense of self, and all the things that you just mentioned, like knockbacks, are part and parcel of being an emerging artist, unfortunately. And they'll probably make everyone, and they make you a stronger artist for it. So one last question, which is really reflective and hopefully not particularly deep, but I want to say, considering what you've achieved so far, if you could go back, what advice would you give to yourself when you started pursuing a creative career?
I would say to him or to myself, prepare to suffer for your art, but also at the same time, try and be in the moment, try and be present in what you're doing at the same time to really enjoy the balance of making theatre and making dance and making art, and take those feelings and really engage with it and be really precious of it, because it could go away in an instant.
I think those are brilliant words that a lot of people will be able to take quite a lot from, so thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for the conversation that we just had. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you for taking part.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. As always, I can't wait for everyone to listen to this, so cheers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Ken for joining me on the podcast. We've definitely covered a lot of new ground there for Starts and Graphs, which is just fantastic. You can check out our link tree to find the work that Ken and our other guests have been making. Please tune in again next week, and in the meantime, follow us on social media at Starts and Grafts on Twitter and Instagram. I've been your host, Connor. Ella has been your producer, and we'll see you again very soon. But until then, take care. Thank you.